It has been said that in order to realize no self, you have to have a self. And what they mean by that is you have to have, really they mean a healthy sense of self. And so if you take a moment and reflect in your own life, whatever areas you have for which there may be some difficulties or struggles, or what we tend to think of as emotional or psychological wounding, for example, if you have issues around shame or self-esteem or worry or anxiety or grief or fear, or the kind of things that all of us have in some version or other, those tend to be the areas within us where we get most identified, most solidified, most contracted around, right? Where we're the least free. And so you can understand if we do some healing around those areas, where those are the areas in which we'll struggle less, the places where we get most, we really create a what I would call an unwholesome sense of self or a suffering sense of self, right? That tends to free up within us. In Western psychological terms, we may tend to think of it as creating a wholesome, healthy self. In Buddhist terms, we wouldn't think in terms of creating a new kind of self that's a healthier, happier self. We would think in terms of healing up the challenging places that really get us caught in suffering. We don't have to create another new version of self in its place. When these difficult places, sometimes they're referred to as our shadow side, because sometimes, oftentimes, there's forces that are unconscious or subconscious at work. We feel the effects. So, for example, pick anything, if it's issues around shame, and if that's up, you're feeling the shame, but there may be whole pieces, large pieces that are inaccessible, that we're not aware of. So they tend to be called shadow sometimes, just meaning not seen. If these places are, if we perceive them, if we understand them, if we're aware of them, it's not so much a problem. If we know how to work with them, we have the tools to work with them. So in and of themselves, these issues aren't necessarily a problem, but they present some challenges for us oftentimes. One of the important aspects, and what I want to focus on tonight, is the aspect or the part of one of the functions of meditation, which is to make conscious what had not been known or what we had not been aware of. Someone recently told me they read something by a well-known Buddhist teacher who said that the purpose of meditation is to make the subconscious conscious. I didn't read it myself, so they may have been paraphrasing or changing the wording. I certainly would not say that's the purpose of meditation. It could be a purpose that you take on from meditation. But I want to back up just for a moment to set the context. Buddhist teachings are about a liberation or a freedom, or an awakening, if you will, often called a liberation through non-clinging. And the non-clinging, which sounds simple enough in concept, covers a lot of territory. There's a lot there in that simple idea of liberation through non-clinging. We're not going to get into all of that tonight. But the whole Dharma is contained in that. What is needed often is some kind of insights or other kind of awareness to support our ability to be free of clinging in a moment. Because if we all know, if someone tells us don't cling, and then we can rest in that place of freedom, if you will, or inner peace, until the right conditions come along and we're hooked back in again. So we, need some help. It's not so easy to do, even though we understand conceptually. That's what the whole practice is about. So we need to back up and ask ourselves what supports us in not clinging, and that's what the insights are all about. And we spend a lot of time talking about insights, directly perceiving or knowing the truths of impermanence and dukkha, suffering, and selflessness or not self. And when we get that really deeply, something can let go in our minds, that in areas where we tend to cling. Right? And that's what we spend a lot of time talking about. What is in service of insight is the meditation practices that we're doing. So I would say the real purpose of meditation, the deepest purpose, is leading to what we would call insight, or more clearly perceiving or understanding or knowing the nature of our own minds and bodies and all experience in service of our own liberation. Or another way that I like to think of liberation is, you could say, our deepest place of well-being. Right? That's what I would say meditation is about. Along with that, there are many, many benefits and fruits that come from meditation practice, many effects that come. And one of the big effects is revealing or making conscious what had been hidden. So it's certainly, you could think of it as a very powerful effect or fruit, something that comes from the practice. But I wouldn't just call it a side effect. It is both, it's just part of what happens with practice, and it is also important in the service of coming to know ourselves, because it is part of ourselves. This piece about revealing or making conscious what had been hidden, that's not the whole picture. Closely connected and very important piece that goes along with that is befriending ourselves. Because when these places start to we become more aware of them, and it's not necessarily just through meditation practice. These same things happen if you do various psychotherapies, or it could be many, many techniques or modalities or approaches that are used. Sometimes it may just be the wisdom that comes through years of living, and we become more self-aware. However we get there, when parts of ourselves or aspects of ourselves become known that perhaps we weren't so aware of before, it can create problems if we're not okay with it. Someone, this is related, it's not exactly the same, but I want to use an example someone used recently about mental illness. I'm not actually talking about mental illness here tonight, because that's a special category, has special challenges and problems and needs special approaches. But there's someone I work with quite a bit who he's a Dharma practitioner, but has struggled with mental illness, but he's doing very well these days. He's on medications that are working, has a psychiatrist, has a therapist. I work with him from a Dharma perspective, and he's doing Qigong, which is just helping tremendously, and he's exercising and let go a lot of unwholesome things he was doing. He's not drinking and doing drugs and just a lot of things. I'm not saying those were the triggering causes, but it was all part of a package, and he's starting to go back to school, and he feels like he's on a good track in his life. And he's just a real sincere Dharma practitioner, and I just spoke with him recently, and he told me that one of the things that was very relieving for him was the idea that this idea of befriending yourself, even including the mental illness. Not saying that if you're having, and of course mental illness is a broad term, so it can apply to many, many different symptoms. In his case, he was having some delusions, and I don't know technically what his diagnosis was or is, but he thought he was Christ. It was one of the manifestations. He was having these kind of delusions and other things. So he wasn't saying that when that's happening, you're not in trouble. And it needed to be dealt with. But once he was out of the acute phases and he was more managing and in his healing process, and he may need a lifetime of drugs or he may get past it. I don't know about that. But he's on this trajectory of healing or being able to function well in the world, we'll say. As he's gotten on this track, he's had shame around the fact of mental illness, the stigmas that people talk about. He felt it. He's never said it came from without, but he felt it. And when he could embrace just the fact of this was part of his makeup, it was what happened to him. It's just what happened. It shifted his whole relationship. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier, this idea that it's sometimes said, and it's meant to be a little humorous, this idea of you have to have a self or a strong self or a healthy self to realize no self. That shame or stigma then wasn't really the mental illness. It was more an emotional or psychological issue he was struggling with but it was about the mental illness. What was happening then? He was identified with whatever the story. It may not have been verbal. I'm trying to verbalize it when I say it may be something like, I'm sick. I'm different than others. You know, there's something wrong with me. I'm fill in the blank. And it creates a lot of suffering. And it becomes a real solid identity. It's a perfect example because right now, that isn't what's true about him. Now, he may have some tendencies or some susceptibilities that he needs to watch out for, but he's functioning quite nicely in the world now. So it's putting that label on himself is actually creating something that not only is creating suffering and it's creating a negative sense of self, but it's not even accurate. It's not who he is. It's how he's making a story up about who he was. And so he found a lot of freedom when he could, I use the term, befriend yourself. Another way to think about it, that's not such traditional Buddhist language, but I happen to like that language a lot because there's a sense of kindness there. There's a sense of self-compassion there that's very, very important. Another way you could say it, self-acceptance, which is similar to befriending yourself. Another way is that we're not, to talk about it, is not creating ill will or aversion to your own being. How often, for many of us, do we fall into an adversarial relationship with ourselves or some aspect of ourselves? I'm too much this, I'm not enough this, whatever it is. So the part that's important is making conscious what had been hidden. There's a lot of levels to that. One level, a big level, important level, is aspects of ourselves that truly were in the subconscious. Those are forces that, whatever it looks like, whether they're wholesome or unwholesome, or you could say positive or negative if you want to use that kind of language, we don't tend to think that way because that adds a judgment, whereas what we mean by wholesome and unwholesome is, are there forces that head us towards more well-being or more happiness or freedom, or are there forces that create suffering? That's all we mean. And it's not a judgment. We all have a mix of both. If those forces were at work, and if we're not even... don't even know what's happening, what's driving some of these behaviors that we do, then we're just at the effect of them, and we don't even know that they're there. You know, the image that's used is often as of a common image of an iceberg, how just, even though they can be quite large, what you can see, they can be huge, but it's only a small percentage, you know, that floats above the water, and it's much, much larger what's underneath. And, you know, they're finding out, people who are doing research in neuroscience, that it's similar to our own neurological processes. A lot's going on that's not conscious. It's still part of what's happening in the brain. It's only a relatively small percentage that we have conscious access to. But that can shift. It may or may not be of interest to gain access to ever bigger piece of that submerged iceberg. I don't know. But certainly, it's of great interest to gain access to the places where there's some volitional force that affects how we think and speak and act, and how we experience ourselves, or that color our perceptions. That's important. That may still only be a relatively small percentage of the whole, of everything that's going on. I just don't know. But if it's not causing us problems, it may not be of value to connect into those places. Or maybe it will be. I'm sure advances in neuroscience and brain science will shed light on a lot of those kind of questions. So there's that whole level of making conscious what had been hidden. One more thing to say about that, though, is some of those forces in us don't necessarily have to be made conscious. They can just be liberated. If the pattern's not running us, or if the pattern shifts, whether you're conscious of it or not. In other words, I'll just make an example here. Each of us have came into this world predisposed in many, many ways, physically predisposed, mentally, psychologically, from a Dharma perspective. At least the traditional view is we came in with our own karma. Some of you may put that in the mix, or some of you may not. And then we all had our life experience. We've all had the places that were challenging, wounding in different ways. We've all hopefully had the places that were supportive and nurturing. So we've had a mix. And we've had how we've responded to all those situations. And so through it all, we each have our unique suffering, although there may be commonalities. We have our unique places of suffering and our own stories. So I'm just going to make up an example here that just to make the point. If I happen to have an issue, let's just say around something where there's some shame about something, that actually happens to not be one of my issues, but I just picked one, it happens to not be one, but say that was mine. But maybe yours is something different. Maybe there's some anxiety that you deal with around something, but it's not connected with shame. Even if there was something subconscious, even if it wasn't so much in the surface, you're totally free around the area of shame. It's just not your issue. It doesn't come up. So you don't have to, it doesn't matter what's subconscious there. There's just no issue happening for you in the first place. And if I don't happen to have the anxiety, I'm totally free. I'm guessing that all of us have probably experienced all of these things at some point. We all know what shame is. We all know what fear and anxiety and, you know, anything you can name. Someone would say, oh, it's not foreign. It's not like you have no idea. What does the term even mean? Of course, so we've all experienced them. That's part of being a human being. When I talk about some issue, then there's maybe it's a conditioned pattern that really has some energy behind it, and it tends to come up for us. That's what I mean when I'm talking about when we say what are really issues, if you will, or psychological areas of wounding, or that's all I'm talking about. That's one whole level. As these things begin to be known and perceived more, it's very important that we are able to meet them in a way that doesn't overwhelm us, that doesn't self-reinforce. So let's just pick, you know, shame, just because it's the example we're using, but we could pick any, whatever it is. When these issues come up, we can feel shame about the fact that we have that even. Because shame only, or whatever the issue is, it only knows it's like a little condition, it's like a little program, computer program. It's a pattern. And it only knows how to do one thing. Shame only knows how to do shame, right? It's not going to do grief. And of course, we can often have mixes, and there could be a lot of things, so it can get complex. I understand that. We're just trying to simplify to make the point. One of the things I've said a number of times to people who tend to be self-critical and beat themselves up, and sure enough, what happens? They beat themselves up because they're so hard on themselves, always beating themselves up. It just, you know, level after level. This is why we need to become more aware. It's a different level of making conscious what had been hidden, because it's not just the subconscious. Oftentimes there's things that are happening in the conscious, but we're not noticing. We're just lost in it. And there's a whole level of waking up. That's waking up out of being on automatic pilot, when all of a sudden you realize, rather than just being at the effect of my anger or my fear, You just know that anger and fear are coming up. It's still happening, but your relationship with it has shifted. So for people who've had a lot of self-judgment or self-criticism, oftentimes don't realize that when they beat themselves up because they're always beating themselves up, it's just the same tape playing again. It's just found something else to land on. So it only knows how to do one thing. And the example I use is, it's like you have a computer program on your computer, and it's a word processor. It's Microsoft Word. When you click on the icon to run that, it's always going to do the same thing. You're always going to get Microsoft Word. You never get an Excel spreadsheet if you click on the Word icon. Doesn't happen, because it only knows how to do one thing. A critical self-judging mind, that's what it does. And it doesn't care. It'll look for anything to land on. It'll land on someone else. It's happy to land on you. It doesn't matter to it. It's just being critical and self-judging. Once we see it in this way, it can shift our relationship. So the befriending part then becomes important. It's not only becomes aware, we become aware of what's happening. But what the befriending does is it can soften our relationship and actually see that the way we've been talking this evening so far is about aspects of ourselves, talking about that they are part of ourselves. But we also, right along with that, don't want to take it too personally. We want to keep the perspective that these are impersonal forces. Yes, it happened to you. So you were saying your issue shame happens to be one of yours. So yes, it's not someone else's unless they happen to have it. It is you, so it's personal in that sense. But we don't want to then fall into what I was talking about earlier, which is then it becomes an identity. So we need to hold it with more lightly or softly and see that it's a conditioned pattern. And so the befriending ourselves part can give us a little space. We're not so reactive. We just start to soften. We start to relax. It brings in the compassion for ourselves. And what's happening is we're suffering less. We feel better. It starts to loosen the grip. It allows us to hang in there with whatever the difficulty is when it's up, because we're okay with it, to whatever degree we're able to be. Whatever areas we've had wounding, I don't know if you can get to the point as if that particular wounding had never happened before, but you can get tremendously free, let's put it that way. No doubt about that. As these things come up, we're able to be with them. Something about, and an important piece is, there are places that often need to be seen. It needs to reveal itself. And oftentimes we don't want to. Maybe we may not be aware even that we're not letting this reveal itself, or we don't want to see it, or we're pushing it away. And there's something quite healing that happens when we can allow the unfolding of our being to happen. And in a sense, part of us gets out of the way and just lets the process unfold, but is able to be present with what's happening with a sense of kindness. The same kindness that you might have towards someone that you cared about deeply. How would you relate to that person when their deepest or darkest or most challenging or difficult parts were coming up? Would you be kind and caring? Would you be able to say, I still love you and care about you, and I'm sorry you're having this suffering? Don't be so hard on yourself. Okay, you've got whatever the issue is. It's part of who you are, but you're still beautiful. I love you. I care about you. However you might hold that other person. What would happen if we could do that for ourselves? So we need to have that befriending ourselves part in there also. For most of us, it's a practice, and it's an ongoing process to strengthen and deepen that. And we'll find that there's aspects of ourselves that we quite naturally or quite easily can be present with in an open-hearted, kind way. And even so, there may be other places where the reactivity is still there, or we contract around it. And so that'll be, it's not all, they're not it's not all equal, and we may need to tend to those areas more over time. So these two parts of making conscious what had been hidden on all these different levels, where, again, whether it was the subconscious or whether it's more the automatic pilot stuff where we're not aware, on all the different levels, becoming more aware and then being able to be present with them, the befriending ourselves part, are very, very important. They're important both for if your the goal for you in meditation or your purpose in meditation is to make, reveal these things and become more aware of them. Or if that's not particularly what you have in mind about meditation, it's more just in the service of liberation and knowing that it's part of what is going to happen. We sit down, we close our eyes, we work with our breath or however you're practicing, and we turn our attention inward. We're strengthening our concentration and our mindfulness and our clarity of knowing what's happening, and so we are going to become more aware. We're turning our attention directly into our own minds and bodies. So we should not expect anything else to happen. We should be aware that that's precisely what we're doing. You know, they talk about plumbing the depths or exploring. So that is what's going to happen. We need to know, be aware.